Well, thank you guys all for being here. And thank you, friendly faces on Zoom, for being here. So I actually offered to give this talk, which is something that I can safely say I have never offered to give a talk in my entire life. But so many people had so many questions, and I started to feel like this was an experience I was really lucky to have, exceptionally lucky. And I kind of feel like it's not my experience particularly to hold on to. It's just, I was lucky to be there and now I'm gone. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
Okay. So I went to Tassajara January 2nd and returned, January 6th and returned April 2nd. And the reason I wanted to go, I first came into Zen after visiting Tassajara in 2014. And it was kind of by accident that we even visited Tassajara. We were looking for a place in Big Sur, and it came up on a Google search. And we knew they had used to have a good bakery in San Francisco, and we went there. And I was very struck with the message on the Han. Great is the matter of life and death, and we have one life. Don't waste it. And it was actually really very startling to me. And it really did stop me in my tracks, and it kind of stopped my life in its tracks a bit too. And I sort of knew then that Tassajara and Zen were going to be part of my life, and I knew I was going to be coming back. I heard people talk about a practice period, and it was just kind of embedded there that it was something I was going to do. So it was the 113th one, and they do one in the fall, one in the spring. I guess that's 56 and a half years. And the way it kind of worked was, or I can tell you sort of about the schedule, and then I'll tell you about my experience. And I kind of went through my notes that I took when I was there. I wrote a lot in a journal. And I don't normally write in a journal, but I felt I felt like I had a lot that I wanted to write down. So the Tongariro, it's actually a 5-day sitting, and it was pretty difficult because it was 5 days. And as I sat there, I kind of realized, though, that it sort of allowed us, me, to kind of, and there were seven of us, by the way, seven Tongariro students, so seven new people that came in. And there were, at that time, I think 22 continuing people, so 22 monastics who had already done Tongariro. So we were the seven Tongariro students, two of whom later did leave, and so it was later just five of us. They didn't leave during Tongariro, though. I felt like, just sitting there, you kind of absorb all of the sounds of the place, the people walking on the gravel, kind of the rhythms of the place, the birds, the light is so different there. The light's really different in the Zendo. It has its own smells, the wood. It's just, there's so much to absorb, and it's so different. And when I would return to my room, I would feel like I had to check something, like messages or mail or email, or there was something to do, but there wasn't. So during Tongariro, I kind of unwound from that and kind of settled into the rhythms of the place. It was hard. And that was kind of juxtaposed with the folks there being so kind to us, serving us three meals a day, or yoki meals a day, just beautiful meals and tea and snack and just being very kind and gracious and setting out water bottles for us at nighttime. So on the one hand, like at times I was almost sobbing with exhaustion. And then at other times I kept thinking I wanted to, you know, it's a beautiful polished wood floor. And I kept having the impulse to slide across it or dance or something. So then that would come up. And then there's at one day I was very anxious. Another day there was all kinds of sadness about, well, just all kinds of sadness that was coming up. The final day I was really irritable with all the formality and the forms. So all of these things were kind of coming and going. And I sort of realized, you know, in my regular life, I have so many mechanisms to avoid it all. You know, I can get away from it, walk away, all kinds of fight or flight, freeze kind of mechanisms. But anyway, so we got through it. And, and then... then we kind of settled into a regular daily rhythm. I'm going to tell you though about, I had this really weird dream that the very first night we were there, and it kind of, well, I'll just tell you about the dream. So the first night we got there, we had lunch, and then we had sort of an orientation, and I met this woman who was very chatty in the bathroom. And then, you know, we finished our orientations and went, and I went to sleep. And I had this dream that I was in this building. It was like a 3-story building that was open in the middle and like balconies all around. And people were, and there was apparently an earthquake because people were falling off these balconies and the building was turning into rubble. And the woman who was so chatty the night before, she fell like this directly on her head, like a pogo stick, bounced right back up and kept talking. And I was very, very worried about her. But meanwhile, there was a crisis, it was clear, but there was all of these monks were dressed in brown robes and they were all kind of scurrying around, busily carrying stacks of papers or food or something. I don't know. They were just busy, busy, busy. So they were hardly interrupted by this. Anyhow, I woke up and then I realized that the building was a building I used to work in called the Mind Institute. So basically, like, people were falling through the mind with nothing to grab onto. And the monastic life is just continuing on. And I seem to be the only one semi-panicked and worried about things. So I think that, anyway, another thing I noticed early on was that things were just so different in there compared to at home. And for one thing, like, things that were important to know, they seemed to say only once. And so I really had to pay attention. And I realized I've gotten in the habit of, like, you know, here, if something's important, you'll hear it in an announcement and then another announcement and you'll get something in the mail and probably 3 emails and then maybe somebody will do it for you, you know. But there, they say it once and that's it. And so I had to be like, really, that was very different for me. So having to pay attention much more closely to things. But then I made a list. This was like in those first couple weeks of all of the things that I thought were different. So here, Tassajara, there are so few things. Out there, the world, so many things. Here, Tassajara, few stories. Out there, continual stories. Here, Paths follow the earth, the mountains twist. There's a massive sky overhead. It's hard to keep my balance when I look up. Out there, the roads are straight, the earth is graded, things move quickly, and regularity is expected. Here, Tassajara, the stars provide context. Out there, stories provide context. Here, time awareness crosses centuries. Out there, time awareness spans hours or days. In here, or here, Tassajara, the big picture, coalescing or not. Out there, fragments flying. Here, nothing happens. A dust bunny is fascinating. Out there, so much happens. A dust bunny goes unnoticed. Here, kindness is prized. Out there, kindness is curious. Here, the monotony of the creek running, the sky filling with stars, monotony of the magnificent. Out there, the monotony of the sensational. Here, viewing my life from afar and within. Out there, stomping in the puddles of my life. Here, Buddha, Buddha, Buddha. Out there, everything else, Buddha, everything else. Here, information is meted out in chunks as needed. Out there, information cascades. Anyway, it was such a distinct difference to me. And the other thing that was really interesting was my family. I noticed that I felt like I have two young adult daughters and my husband, and I felt like I was witnessing what would happen if I had died, because I was suddenly gone and they were kind of left to reorganize themselves with the dog and, you know, and look out for each other. And it was really interesting and kind of surprising to see how they did it. Yeah, so it was very humbling to be there, I have to say. You know, all of these new forms, you know, there's endlessly detailed forms, and I was so often getting everything wrong, which I called my Dennis the Menace days. And there was one, within one 24-hour period, I broke my eyeglasses, my electric toothbrush of 10 years died, and one of my chopsticks flipped over a rail into some shrubs and couldn't be found. That was one Dennis the Menace day. But they were continual. And I have a few here, listed here, but I won't go into that. Yeah, and so kind of looking at my journal, what I jotted in my journals, I wrote another Dennis the Menace day, but a good one. January 15th, exhausted and happy. January 24th, this monastery has its own rhythms, its own heartbeat. I'm a blood cell getting pulsated through. Thank you. January 25th, it rained today, smelled wonderful. A moth flitting on the dining room altar, clouds moving across the mountains. All of these moments that get crowded out by the noise of modern life. And then we had three sessions subsequently. We had a 5-day, a 9-day, and a 7-day. And so the 5-day was the first one. And I did write a little poem at the end of that one, which I'll read. Session days 4 and 5. Deep settling. Is this a kind of happiness? And with it, a pool of quiet, still sadness, untouched for generations. Sitting with it. The world cracks open just a bit. Box and lid no longer fit. Is this the Dharma wheel turning? And so I felt like I was having a lot of just unique experiences, just quiet experiences that I wasn't, used to in day-to-day life. Here's a quote that I really like. I did a lot of reading when I was there too, by the way. And a Thich Nhat Hanh quote I came across where he says, "Buddhist practice is doing everyday things simply and with joy." Yeah, so they have a really great library, and I basically, in our limited free time, slept and read books. And let's see, I have a list of what I read when I was there. So I read Umbrella Man, the essays about Mel Weitzman. I looked at this beautiful, like coffee table art history picture book about the life of the Buddha. Through art, paintings and carvings. I read How to Sit by Thich Nhat Hanh. I read a novel by Ruth Ozeki, My Year of Meat. She's kind of a Buddhist writer. And I read that like on a personal day. And it was fun. It was, but it was, after that, I decided I wasn't going to read any more novels because it was just too hard being pulled between these two, states, kind of. And I was making like a phone call a week to my husband and my daughters, and for the most part, after that, we just stuck with letter writing for the same reason. So we wrote a lot of letters. I read Zen Women by Grace Shireson. I read One Robe, One Bowl, The Poetry of Ryokan, which I totally enjoyed. Not Always So, Suzuki Roshi. Zen Keys, Thich Nhat Hanh. Instructions to a Young Monk, Thich Nhat Hanh. Haiku Handbook, Higginson and Harder. Brush Mind by Kaz Tanahashi. Zenju Earthlin Manual, The Shamanic Bones of Zen, which was amazing. And Sanctuary. The Way of Siddhartha, A Life of the Buddha. And a really cool book called Unsui, A Diary of Zen Monastic Life, that I found in the library. It was a 19th century person kind of made drawings to depict his, kind of funny drawings actually, to depict his. Do you know the book, Oscar? Isn't it fun?
Sarah lent it to me.
Okay. I thought it was so much fun. Yeah. And so it was to depict his everyday life. And then a scholar used these books to illustrate to his audiences, his contemporary audiences, what life was like in a Zen monastery. And then they ended up publishing it as a book. And it's remarkably like what day-to-day life was like at Tassajara. Like remarkably. But with these kind of great characters. Yeah, so 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 at that point, though, I was kind of getting very homesick, and I kind of felt like, well, I've been here a month. I've done Tongariro. I did the 5-day. I gave away Seeking Mind talk. I want to go home. I'm ready to go home. What else is there? And I felt like my hands were always stained up from working in the kitchen, and my clothes smelled like the kitchen, and my sleeves were always wet from the dish room, and my legs were always sore. And I was just so homesick. And I later found out that we all were actually around that time very homesick. It was around then that two of the people left for different reasons. But yeah, so I was kind of thinking, like, well, what else is there? I've done it all. Can't I go home now? And then I remember this. There's a morning where, what happened? So want to conflate these two incidents. Okay, so I had been on fire watch the night before. Oh, and that was the other thing. I had learned all these jobs the first month. So you have to spend so much energy learning these various roles and trying not to fall down on the job. You know, like fire watch was my favorite. And, so with the fire watch, I don't know if people are familiar, but you, and I remember it because the first time I went to Tassajara years ago, we had a gas lantern in our room, and someone came around and was knocking this wood in front of our door, which was annoying. And then we realized, oh, they're telling us to turn off the lantern. It's lights out, fire watch. And so even though there aren't so many gas lanterns, they continued that. So it's basically to say lights out. So the fire watch person closes up the kaisando and makes sure all the doors are locked and makes sure the dining room doors and windows are closed and all the lights are off and checks the lower shack and the upper shack to make sure doors are closed and refrigerators are closed and ovens are turned off. And then you walk to the end of the kind of like the main street, and with these two pieces of wood connected by like a rope around your neck, and then you kind of strike them together. So you go with your steps. So it's you strike 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and it's pretty loud actually. Strike 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Strike 2, strike 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. And so then that pattern continues, and you just walk all the way down slowly, making this in this quiet sort of camp. It was absolutely, I was totally thrilled. It was so beautiful. And then you check to make sure that the garden gates are closed so the deer can't get in. And so then the next day after that, which is even better because since you're up, you know, later than most, you skip the first period of Zazen. So I had skipped the first period of Zazen, like I was allowed to do. And I was a server, and I think it was a personal day. And I thought we were eating in the dining room. And so I went over to the dining room, and nobody's there. So I start wiping down tables, and still nobody's there. And then I start sweeping, nobody's there. And so I think, well, I better go check the pantry, see if there's something going on. And I go there, and the other servers are all waiting, like, where have you been? And they're handing out the tasks, and one person is going to be hitting this umpan, big, round, kind of metal instrument to go with the serving choreography. And so the only role left was to hit the fish drum and this other drum. And I'm not very good at this kind of thing. So when I've done it, the other times I did it, I studied really hard and I memorized it, you know, like the 15 minutes before, you know, I was thinking, you know, okay, they step, I hit, step, hit, every four, blah, blah, and kind of rolling through it in my head, but I had no chance to prepare. And so I had to go up to the, and you're kind of really in the spotlight. So I went up to the fish drum. Oh, and then the other part of this role is that you have to signal to the person on the umpan when to start and when to stop. And it's dark out still, so the only way to do it's with the flashlight. So I thought, okay, I'm going to study for my fish drum while I'm up there waiting. And then, so I'm reading the directions, and then the light overhead went out. And I thought, okay, well, I have this flashlight, but I can't turn it on because then she's going to start hitting the umpan and it's not time for it yet. And so it's pitch dark. I can't read the directions, and I'm going to have to be playing this fish drum. And so I was looking at Karen's face. I muddled through it. Then I had to go over to the other drum and where I was even more clueless. I don't know what happened. Anyway, so I finished this very awful, this is basically my nightmare too, by the way. This is my nightmare, being unprepared for something and being in the spotlight and just completely messing it up. And so anyway, I walked to the back and I saw the other servers and I said to one of, I apologized quietly, you know, and the senior person there, she just smiled and shrugged and kept doing her thing. And I realized that I felt almost no shame, which was mind-boggling for me because that's part of my thing, you know, and I felt almost no shame at all about this, and I just kind of kept flowing with it. And so I had like a lot of really nice moments like that, or just not nice, but I mean, unexpected, I guess. Things kept coming up, you know, while I was there. Let's see. I guess the other thing is, when I was feeling so homesick, I got the idea, well, then I started trying to break up the time into manageable chunks. It's 90 days. And I was like, 9 times 10, no. 10 times 9, no. 7 days times, what, 12 and a half or something, no. And I finally settled on 15 times 6. So I had 6 chunks of 15 days, and I was kind of moving through it in this way. And even then, it was going too slow. And so then I got the idea, I realized that it felt to me like we were on a spaceship and we were orbiting the Earth. And I just kept playing with this little idea and developing it. And it really kind of kept me out of the homesickness for a while. And it kind of worked. Mm-hmm. Like, because here you are, you're in this place. You feel like you're in the stars because your view of the sky is just amazing. You can see so many stars every night and every morning. You feel like you're just launched into the sky. It was like we were on this little spaceship and we had our little routines and everything's very tightly managed. And we're so far away from the Earth. And we hear bits of news, just tiny bits, occasionally. But they're like following everything we do, or at least my family was. And, you know, we're thinking about life all the time on Earth and kind of exploring. And I was telling myself, this ship's not landing for another 40 days. And we have an upcoming 9-day excursion. And well, hopefully we'll learn something. And and I thought like gravity is even different here. Both literal, like you're more embodied in much of the time, or I was anyway. And then like what's weighty and important felt very different. Time felt very, very different there. People would reference something that happened in the morning. And I was have to rack my brain. It felt like it was 2 days ago. And since I've come back, time is really, I'm not really in sync yet either. Everything seems to take, you know, I think something's going to, I can leave the house in 5 minutes and suddenly it's 20 minutes and I'm out of the house and I have no idea, you know, so I'm not really, anyway, so time was different there. Yeah, and so what else can I say? Yeah, we did the 9-day sesshin was really interesting. The kitchen staff, there were I think 5 or 6 people in the kitchen staff, and during the 9-day sesshin, they invited folks who had done the fall practice period to come back if they wanted and work in the kitchen, so that all the kitchen staff could do the sesshin 100% of the time, which was really nice. And so during the 9-day, I I had so much trouble staying awake during the second sitting of each day, especially. And so somebody said, oh, why don't you try some invigorating yoga? Just get up a little earlier and do some invigorating yoga. And I thought, okay, I'll try it. And so the first day I got up early, and I'm pretty sure I just strained a muscle and was even more sleep deprived, super irritable. The second day, I woke up, felt so much better. And as I was sitting there, I was listening to the kitchen staff, and I could hear them chanting the Heart Sutra. And I was like, oh, that's interesting. You know, it's a different chef or a different, you know, Tenzo, and she has them chanting the Heart Sutra. And then they chanted it again. And I'm following along, and I'm kind of enjoying it. And all of the places, like, where I'm not sure what the next line is, they knew. And it's like, yeah, that's right, that's right. And so I'm following along. And then it occurred to me, maybe they're not chanting the Heart Sutra. Maybe, in fact, they were not. It was the creek was flowing. And it sounded, in my head, the Heart Sutra was being chanted over and over again, including all the words that I can't always know. I don't always know. So that was kind of, I don't know, it's kind of funny. So, yeah, so, well, and then I'll just tell you, let's see, if there's anything. Oh. And then here's a funny story that happened. So after somebody left, I was the Tenzo's assistant in the kitchen, which was super fun, because there's like a gigantic salad spinner, like 3 feet tall. And when I made the salad, there's so much salad that you put on gloves all the way up to your elbows and you toss it with your hands. So it's really fun. Gigantic walks, and yeah, so I really enjoyed that, and part of my job was to take inventory of everything and keep up the inventory list. And so this one day, let's see, I said to the Tenzo, I said, we had just gotten in a delivery, and I said, there's some unlabeled beans in the lower shack that just came in. Do you know what they are? And she said, what do they look like? I said, I don't know, the bag's sealed. I'm reluctant to open it unless we have to. And she's looking through the computer and she says, oh, those are the azuki beans. And I said, okay, great. And then this guy standing behind us said, I thought you were talking about beings sealed up in bags that you were afraid to look at. So anyway, there's plenty to say, but I feel like I should kind of stop here and leave room for questions if people would like.
Wow, what a great story. Thanks for sharing all of that. How did the experience change your practice? And if so, how might it have?
Did being there change my practice? Is that the question? It's still kind of evolving, honestly. I feel like I'm still halfway there. I feel like I'm still halfway there, so.
You're still processing the experience, you mean?
Yeah, and I just feel like my mind and my thoughts and my way of I'm just often thinking of the people there, the routines, the chants, the this, the that, the books, the places, the smells, the food, the, you know, so I'm only halfway, I feel like I'm only halfway here and still kind of stuck there with, not stuck, but still residing there kind of with those experiences. Yeah. So I don't know yet.
Great.
Andrea has her hand up.
Andrea has her hand up.
Hi. Hi, Malia. Thank you for your talk. I had my camera off, but I was listening the whole time. And I really appreciate what you were sharing about the different ways you were interacting with your environment while you were at Tassajara, as far as keeping a journal, and then also remembering what you read, and then noticing all of the subtle differences between, I love the list that you had of what was, how things were different at Tassajara versus, you know, outside of the monastery setting. And so I wanted to ask you, over the weekend, I just got back from spending 4 days at Disneyland, and that environment is the complete counterpoint, right, to the monastic setting where it's designed to cultivate amusement. It's designed to cultivate joy and nothing but positive feelings, right? And it was really cool to go there and practice and just pay attention to all the invitations to engage with my senses in that environment. And I knew your talk was going to be tonight. And so I was wondering, you know, if you've been able to really even articulate it yet, because I hear you say, you know, you're still processing your experience. Given that you were in the monastic environment, what would you say was most supportive in that environment of mindfulness?
What was most supportive of mindfulness, or what was most supportive?
What was most supportive in that environment for your mindfulness practice? Was there something that you were aware of, or like, this is actually really helping me feel grounded or more connected with the immediate experience that I'm having, or something like that?
I mean, I would say the schedule for sure, because just keeping to that takes so much. And, but if you keep to it, you keep moving, you know? Mm. Yeah, just adhering to that, I think, was very supportive for me. I'm reminded, I didn't mention this, but one of the final days that I was there, I was a server that day. I was the head server. And so I got to run the meal boards and stuff. And then it was just a regular day. I was just doing the regular stuff I did there. And I was walking around and I realized, this is one of the happiest days of my life. I was just so happy. I mean, that was how kind of I felt much of the time I was there, just purely happy. Different kinds of happy too, different ways of being happy that I didn't know about, that I didn't even... It's hard to even put my finger on, oh, it's happy. I mean, you know, that's such a generic word, you know. I guess it's probably used a lot at Disneyland, but yeah.
Yes, that's the idea, right?
It's place on earth.
It's cultivated. But I appreciate you sharing that there are these new experiences you had of happiness that maybe you hadn't had the opportunity to experience before outside of the setting.
Most of my 3 months there felt very unique to me, for me. Yeah. Even though it was, you know, exactly, I was doing exactly what everyone else is doing and what people have been doing for generations or, you know, at monasteries, but it felt, for me, it was extremely different way of moving in the world and, you know, and living. Yeah.
Oh, thank you so much.
Plus it's communal too, you know. So.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing. I would love to talk more about it with you. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you for sharing your experiences there. Very interesting to listen to human beings. I'm wondering how it was either similar or different than the practice period at Green Gulch. I mean, I have a feeling like the geography is different and it must make the experience different. It seems like more confined at Tassajara, you know, that valley and like, but, and maybe longer and more intense, but I'm just curious what you think.
Yeah, it was a lot more intense, actually. Yeah, it's 3 months rather than 2 months, and there's much more sitting there, and then it's wearing robes all the time, basically, except during work practice. And there, it's more serious, kind of. I mean, I loved being at Green Gulch. I thought it was like paradise. But yeah, no, it was more intense, I guess. I felt so far away there, and nobody can visit either, you know. So, yeah. I think the schedule was much more demanding.
I bet Green Gulch helped prepare you, because I remember you saying, as to the 7-day sesshin at Green Gulch, you said at day five I was like done. and today you say you just said and we did a 9-day sesshin, and that's all you had to say about it. So it must.
No, I actually have a lot more to say.
Oh.
But I won't. Yeah.
Thank you so much, Malia. And I was just especially moved by your sharing the experience of suddenly hearing the Heart Sutra and thinking it was the cooks who were singing it, and then all of a sudden realizing, no, it was, you know, it was the rivers and the mountains and everything. And, you know, just reading a lot about, you know, suchness or emptiness means there are no sides, no bottoms, no walls. Everything is completely open, and so everything is everything. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's the mind. Really, so it's just very moving, because we can hear that. I mean, that's basically saying all of that's happening, mm-hmm. all the time. Everything is singing the Heart Sutra.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Yeah, and that feeling of kind of fluidity, like yes. I felt that so much there. And I actually, this is similar to Green Gulch. I remember there was a point, because Larry and Clem were at Green Gulch at the same time I was, and I remember there was a point when we were there, and it seemed like everybody was giving everybody the benefit of the doubt. Just everybody was so good to everybody else, and kind and generous and open. You know, they'd like discarded the, you know, day-to-day stuff they maybe came in with, all the defensiveness. And then, so there was a point at Tassajara where I realized, oh, that same thing is happening. You know, everyone's just saying yes to everybody and smiling. And then I noticed like somebody who never smiled at me was smiling at me. And I realized, oh, I had smiled at her. And I probably had never smiled at her. And then I realized, oh, maybe it's me. Maybe I'm the, you know, being smiley. And then I think it was both, of course, but, anyway, just to the speaking yes, to the sense of fluidity smile. And flow and openness.
Yes, and even the smiling, it's not you or her. It's somehow smiling is happening, kind of like that.
Yeah.
And you're all participating. And,
yeah.
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you. Karen.
Thank you, Malia. Gosh, it was was wonderful to hear your stories. I couldn't help but think that, I mean, just comparing your experience, at least what you've told us, with being there in the way back years, where there were a lot more students there, for one thing. And so I think that because there were fewer students when you were going there, it seems like you had an opportunity to do a lot of different kinds of jobs. Whereas, you know, when I was there, you'd have a main job, and then, yes, you would do some bell ringing, or you can do fire watch and that kind of thing. But the reason I was making that face, I think, is about, you know, hitting the drum. I mean, it wouldn't be usual for a person who was in their first practice period to do that, least when I was there, at least as far as I knew. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I applaud your your buoyancy about it. And you know, I mean, it is kind of, it's really beautiful to think that by doing that schedule, you actually do kind of get over yourselves in some ways.
Yeah, yeah.
Because you become a part of grass, trees, and walls, I guess.
Yeah.
You know, so that was really beautiful to hear.
Yeah, I mean, I noticed that, like, you know, making so many mistakes or whatever, and then if I'd see someone later in the day, at first I was inclined to say, oh, I'm sorry, I gave the wrong signal for that, or blah, blah, blah. And then I realized nobody really cares. They've forgotten about it, and so should I. You know, and I just kind of stopped apologizing and let those things fall away.
I loved your metaphor also of the spaceship, you know, being among, I mean, it seems like the sky and the stars, the darkness, you know, it's really, it made a big impression on you, and mm-hmm. that is very special. But anyway, I like that metaphor too. Thank you.
Oh, Katrina.
I just primarily want to say thank you. It was really great to have you share so much and in just such an honest, open, vulnerable way. I appreciate that. This is just kind of curiosity. Can you tell us what the daily schedule is like? You referred to how it affected you. I'm just curious what your day was like.
Yeah, so it was like on a five-day series, a five-day rotation. And it was 3 days of, they called monastic days, and then a work day. And we had more work than you probably had, Karen, because there was more work to be done and fewer people to do it. So even for Tassajara, that was a little unusual. So a work day and then a personal day, and which is more like a personal 10 hours because you're doing stuff in the morning and evening. But the monastic days, it's wake up at 4:20, and then in the Zendo by 4:50. And then I think you sit until 5:30, and then Kinhin 5:40, sit again till 6:10, roughly, and then breakfast, maybe finish Orioki. Oh, no, I'm sorry, then service, and then Orioki breakfast. So it ends at maybe 7:25 or so. And then you get maybe 20 minutes, 25 minutes rest, at which time I would take a nap. And then study hall, I think was like 8 to 8:40 or something. And then soji work, so some light work for another 30 minutes or so. And then I think there was maybe a 20-minute break, and then I think there was another sitting or a Dharma talk or a class. Kinhin, sitting, a noon service, or Yoki lunch. And then by this time it's about noon, and then there's a break, 25 minutes, 30 minutes, something like that. And then again, more napping for me. And then work circle at about 1 o'clock. And then you work until 3:45, which I really enjoyed. I really enjoyed the working and I really enjoyed the chanting especially, but yeah. So working till 3:45 or 4:15, depending. And then at 4:15, everybody's off and it's exercise. We were strongly encouraged to exercise and bath until 5:30, I think. And then back to the Zendo service, Oryoki dinner, break, 45 minutes break after dinner. And then I think just one sitting in the evening and then singing the refuges and then done at 8:25. Yeah, 8:25 p.m. And then I was in bed at 8:30 and asleep by 8:31.
Thank you for sharing. As someone who's never done something like that, it's really interesting to hear kind of the nitty-gritty. It makes it very real to at least to imagine. You mentioned a period when you first get there that's pretty intensive, which I'd never heard the term before. And I was wondering what that was and how that's different than either the schedule you just described and something like Sesshin.
Yeah, so Tongariro. So like at Green Gulch, we had a one-day Tongariro, but at Tassajara, it's 5 days. So I think it's an artifact of ancient times when people would go to the monastery and knock and ask to be let in, to become a monk, and they'd say no, and then the person would sit outside and prove how badly they wanted to be there and knock again and ask again, and they'd say no, and they'd keep sitting and being a model student, and then so you kind of recreate that symbolically, I think. So it's basically the same as that monastic schedule day, but in between they just kind of ignore you, but you're expected to be in the Zendo sitting. So from like after breakfast, so all day long you sit. There's nobody's monitoring. All day long you sit for 5 days.
And do you sleep there too?
No, you get to go sleep in your own room. And you eat the Oryoki meals, you know, with everybody else. And everybody else is coming in for, you know, meals and service and morning service and evening service. Yeah. But the rest of it, yeah, it's hard. And the irony, you know, it was so strange to me. It's like I'm not doing anything. And it's so hard, you know, not to move.
Do you also participate in the services when people come in during that time?
Yeah. The services are really beautiful there too. Just the instruments are beautiful and it's really nice.
I just wanted to thank you so much for sharing. It was wonderful, and I'm glad you're back.
Oh, thank you. Good to see you.
You too.
Well, thank you so much. What an honor, and more will be unfolding, and we'll be here to support you too during all of that.
Thank you.
Transformation that's still happening.
Yeah, and I mean, of course I wouldn't have been able to go at all if we didn't have a Sangha here, if Jim didn't support and write letters of support for me, you know, if you guys, if we didn't have all of this, I wouldn't have been able to do any of that. Mm-hmm. And my husband made tremendous sacrifice over 3 months for me to be able to go. Mm-hmm. You know, Jody filled in for me as secretary, which was awesome. So, yeah, people have been extremely supportive, which I so appreciate. Mm-hmm.